This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for being with us on this Thursday, February 16th. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president expresses high hopes for Middle East peace as he welcomes the leader of Israel.
I'm looking at two state and one state, and I like the one that both parties like. I'm very happy with the one that both parties like. I can live with either one. I thought for a while the two-state looked like it may be the easier of the two. But honestly, if Bibi and if the Palestinians, if Israel and the Palestinians are happy, I'm happy with the one they like the best.
President Donald Trump, as you just heard, welcomed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, projecting a message of unity during a White House meeting today, even as Trump suggested he was open to alternatives to a two-state solution. Now, Trump's suggestion that the U.S. could back a single state as a long-term solution for the region potentially upends decades of U.S. diplomatic efforts aimed at creating an independent Palestinian state alongside Israel. Netanyahu also refused to commit to a two-state solution while outlining what he believes is the key to finding peace.
The two prerequisites of peace, recognition of the Jewish state and Israel's security needs west of the Jordan, they remain pertinent. We have to look for new ways, new ideas on how to reinstate them.
On Wednesday, Trump also said he'd like to see the U.S. embassy moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
I'd love to see that happen. We're looking at it very, very strongly. We're looking at it with great care, believe me. And we'll see what happens.
The meeting between the two leaders follows a period of rocky U.S.-Israel relations during the past eight years. Former President Barack Obama and Netanyahu clashed frequently over issues including Israeli settlements and the Iran nuclear deal. Joining me now for more on this first meeting between the two leaders, former U.S. Ambassador to Azerbaijan, Richard Kalzlerich. Sir, you spent a lot of time working in Israel, right?
I spent 3 years at our embassy in Tel Aviv in the 1980s when Menachem Begin and Shamir were prime ministers. And so, you know, I've seen the U.S. policy on settlements be rather consistent over that. What Obama said about settlements and the problems that they create for achieving a Israeli solution wasn't really that different than what we had been saying for decades. Now, Trump has done a couple of things. The idea that we would move our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem was one thing that came up fairly early on after Trump was inaugurated. This is really a very, very troublesome development because the U.S. has strongly held we will not do that until there is peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians, including the status of Jerusalem. The reaction in the Arab world, if we were to take this actually physically shutting down our embassy in Tel Aviv and moving it to Jerusalem, would be horrendous.
And can you give me examples of why it would be horrendous?
For the Palestinians, Jerusalem is the capital of a peace agreement. Any particularly effort by the United States to somehow declare for one side or the other's view of the status of Jerusalem would be a cause for concern and potentially a security threat to U.S. interests in the Arab world, from demonstrations, from possible terrorist acts and things of that nature. Now, the second issue in addition to that, so that need to watch how that particular thing plays out during the visit. The second one is relations with Iran. You know, President Trump has come out very strongly, hardline position on Iran. Netanyahu has been very much in favor of that. The nuclear agreement, the P5 plus one, is something Trump regards as a bad deal. But if now the United States would either remove its support from that agreement that resulted in Iran backing down on nuclear weapons procurement activities, interestingly, it would put the United States and Russia on different paths. Russia would be very concerned about that because of its relationship with Iran. There are questions in Russian minds already about the U.S. position because of this would be another, for Moscow, another sign that the U.S. was moving in a direction that was against Russian interests, in favor of Russian interests.
Palestinian officials have reacted pretty negatively to suggestions that the U.S. would abandon the effort to reach a two-state solution. U.S. officials and many Israelis have long expressed opposition to the one-state solution, saying it would endanger Israel's Jewish and democratic nature. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump launched new attacks on Wednesday against media reports of alleged links between him and Russia, blaming the country's intelligence community for what he said were illegal leaks to news outlets. Russia, meanwhile, Wednesday dismissed a New York Times report that members of Trump's campaign and other associates were in contact with senior Russian intelligence officials ahead of the November U.S. election. International edition Sarah Williams spoke with VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf about the Russian comments.
Well, the Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov pointed out that these were anonymous sources and therefore they were extremely dubious in his view, saying they're not based on any facts. They don't point out anything that is true, and referencing the idea of fake news, saying that you shouldn't trust such anonymous sources. So pretty much a denial of any kind of intelligence contacts, and they've always denied any kind of spying that goes on or intelligence related to either the U.S. election campaign or the Trump campaign or the officials who are around President Trump. So it didn't come as a big surprise that they would deny such a thing.
Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, is one of the people named in this New York Times report. And, you know, his name keeps resurfacing. And I believe that one of the reasons he was replaced as campaign manager was because of his ties to the Russians.
Yeah, that's what they say. There was concerns anyway about his ties, apparently. At least that's what, you know, we were led to believe by reports that came out. And certainly, you know, these increasing concerns about ties between aides or advisors to, you know, President-elect Trump and now President Trump is raising a lot of suspicion. And it's interesting to see the Russian reaction to all of this going on in the United States. Predictably, among a lot of the Russian lawmakers, we see some fairly strong comments that this it could signal a change towards anti-Russian hysteria within the Trump administration, that it may or that it may be part of a witch hunt to go after anyone who wants to improve ties with Russia. And, you know, so interesting kind of contradictory, but, you know, somewhat angry and concerned statements, we could say, coming out from a lot of Russian lawmakers. But the Kremlin has been fairly steady in saying that this is the situation with the resignation of the former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, was an internal matter of the United States, and that Russia will not comment on it. The Kremlin will not comment on it. But it is interesting also to note that the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, had denied that any discussion of sanctions to Russia had taken place between Mr. Flynn and the Russian ambassador to the United States. And of course, Mr. Flynn himself later came out indicating that they had actually touched on that issue and the issue of the expulsion of Russian diplomats in the United States. So interesting to see the Kremlin Kremlin spokesman appearing to come to the defense of the U.S. official who later then was forced to resign over some of his withholding of information from his supervisors in the Trump administration.
Yeah, because as you noted, during the last days of the Obama administration in December, there was a decision by the U.S. to expel dozens of Russian diplomats. And that, you know, followed allegations of Russian cyber spying against the Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton during the presidential campaign. So, you know, it seems like there are some heightened tensions, certainly diplomatic tensions at the moment between the two countries.
Certainly this is not going to help with relations between the two sides. I mean, it's, you know, there was a lot of euphoria and expectation and hopes here in Russia that with the election of President Trump, that there would be some very clear moves towards improving bilateral relations after, you know, they've sunk to the lowest levels in, you know, years with Russia's annexation of Crimea and support for Russia for separatists in eastern Ukraine. So there certainly was a feeling that based on President Trump's statements during his campaign when he was running for office that he wanted to really improve relations. He famously or infamously complimented President Putin, depending on which what your views are on that issue, and also, questioned the situation in Ukraine and gave indications that, sanctions against Russia could be lifted.
International Edition's Sarah Williams speaking with VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Trump defends his national security advisor that he ousted. Andrew Puzder withdraws as U.S. Labor Secretary nominee. Governors call on Trump to back renewable power sources. House conservatives offer a health care plan to replace Obamacare. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. In response to President Donald Trump's pledge to increase deportation of immigrants living in the country illegally, build a wall along the Mexican border, and ban people from certain majority Muslim countries from coming into the U.S., organizers in cities across the United States are telling immigrants to miss class, miss work, and not shop on Thursday as a way to show the country how important they are to America's economy and way of life. A Day Without Immigrants actions are planned in cities including Philadelphia, Washington, Boston, and Austin, Texas. Joining me now for more on this is Monica Gomez-Isaac, Executive Director of the Institute for Immigration Research at George Mason University. Thanks for being with us. Tell us about this event.
We're seeing an overall response by immigrants and immigrant groups who are in solidarity to demonstrate what an American society would actually look like if we were to see an absence of the output and contributions of immigrants. It is directly emphasizing or responding to the recent executive actions and orders that President Trump recently signed to demonstrate that really, the contributions that immigrants provide to this country are overwhelming and should be recognized.
This is just sort of a grassroots movement that has taken hold and the word has spread through social media, basically?
That's what we're seeing a great deal of. And so individual businesses, individuals themselves are sharing with their friends and families, their colleagues, that really this is a day to participate as a way of showing support for immigrants, but also to demonstrate what paralysis would appear if immigrants were not able to help mobilize the nation in its day-to-day activities, whether it be in forms of commerce or ensuring that general day-to-day operations take place.
Any idea how many people are actually expected to participate, or should we say not participate?
Right, right. It's not certain, and I'm guessing this is going to be a lot like what took place with the Women's March in the Washington, D.C. area the day after the inauguration. There were some estimates, however, ultimately we won't know about how many people will actually participate until the event is over. I can't say what the gravity will be on this particular occasion.
Do we know how many immigrants are living, working, and participating in the U.S. economy right now?
What we do know is based on the 2010-2014 American Community Survey, which is derived from the U.S. Census Bureau. This is the most accurate information we have available, and it's estimated in the country overall there are 143 million people employed. But of that entire number, approximately 16.7% of those workers are foreign-born. So while it doesn't seem like a very large percentage, it does have an impact on specific industries, especially.
I mean,
sure.
It's hard to say at this point, right? How many people will or will not participate in this, whether it's going to be huge or not?
You're right. It is hard to say because, for one thing, I think we're living in a climate where there is a great deal of fear. There is a sense of uncertainty in which even those individuals who are in support of boycotting, they also have to be mindful that this may potentially put them at danger for being deported or being somehow questioned. And that involves taking a huge risk. And people are already under so much scrutiny as it is in light of suspicion and just a sense of mistrust within our communities that while there may be turnout, I don't doubt there will be turnout for these boycotts, I don't know if it will actually be an accurate reflection of how much support there actually is for these kinds of statements that are being made because of that fear.
And the other perspective of all of this is the academic world.
We know for a fact that there are many foreign-born individuals who work in academic settings. They bring a plethora of knowledge and expertise that our country depends on in order to not only generate the next generation of students and scholars, but these people are at the forefront of incredible discoveries, whether it be in science and technology, or leading in capacities of innovative ideas that make it possible for entrepreneurship to take place, to make us the best and the brightest. There is a large number of Nobel Prize winners that are American, but were foreign-born. And if we're going to accurately take a look at how immigrants impact our country, we can't just look at it from a perspective on one day in terms of what they provide. It is actually a legacy of what they provide over generations. And that's what makes it a fundamental component to our country's identity, our history, and ultimately what will lead this country into the future for many, many generations to come.
All right. Monica Gomez-Isaac, Executive Director of the Institute for Immigration Research. Thanks for being with us. This is International Edition on VOA.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues now with a look at what's trending on social media. And for that, we're joined by G. Abby Lee. Hey, G.
Hey, Lori.
So Kellyanne Conway, the Trump counselor's trending the past couple of days.
That's right.
What's going on now?
She's trending in relation to the American broadcaster MSNBC. The cable network's morning show host Mika Brzezinski said on air that she doesn't, quote-unquote, believe in fake news and that Ms. Conway is no longer welcomed on her show. Leading up to that comment, other media outlets such as Mediate and Vox have suggested she should not be invited to news programs if her answers do not shine light on the administration's policies and direction. So John Ziegler, who is a Mediate columnist, shared a link to his opinion piece and tweeted, "When I wrote this yesterday, I didn't expect Morning Joe, that's the name of the program, to take me up on my suggestion of banning Kellyanne Conway."
Wow.
But not everyone thinks the decision by MSNBC will have an impact on Conway. A conservative Twitter user named Paul Watson sent out this sarcastic tweet. "I'm sure Conway will be distraught about being frozen out by one of the lowest-rated news shows in existence."
Ouch.
Yep. But people who are in support of the decision said the ban cannot stop at Conway and needs to include Stephen Miller, who is a senior advisor to President Trump.
Okay. Well, I'll see how that all plays out. What else is trending?
Also in the intersection of TV and politics, actor Ashton Kutcher testified before Senate about child sexual slavery. As you may know, Kutcher and his ex-wife Demi Moore co-founded Thorn, a nonprofit aimed at helping to end modern slavery. And during the hearing, he gave very emotional testimony about his knowledge of the issue. Twitter users are sharing clips from the hearing and also writing that Kutcher has been fighting sex trafficking for years and is a very smart investor in startups and tech companies.
Right, he is a major investor of Warby Parker and also Airbnb.
Two very big startups.
Absolutely. Anything else?
Yeah, shares of American sports retailer Under Armour have been sliding for the past few days after its CEO Kevin Plank called President Trump a real asset. So on Wednesday, Plank has backtracked with a full-page newspaper ad in Baltimore, and a digital copy of his statement is making the rounds on social media. Back to you.
All right, thanks, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. Well, emergency rooms across the U.S. deal with many things, including overdoses. Drug addiction is an issue that seems to go beyond a person's age or income level. Joining me now to talk more about the issue, Gloria Anderson, supervisor of the addiction program at the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation. Thank you for being with us. So, is drug addiction under control here in the United States, or are more people falling prey to it?
Yeah, Lori, we would say that drug addiction is on the rise. The New York State report came out in 2013 saying there was a 40% rise in drug-related deaths from 2009.
Wow, that's quite a jump for sure. Is it mainly due to prescription drugs?
We are seeing a vast overprescribing of prescription painkillers, and that's one way that people get introduced to drugs, as well as, like, we see where with opiates in particular, like, children are going into parents' or grandparents' medicine cabinets and getting introduced to opiates by finding prescription pain pills in their cabinets.
Right, and in the last week or so, we've heard about 151 overdoses in just 4 days in Louisville, Kentucky. That certainly would seem like a part of a growing opioid epidemic, at least in Kentucky. Pretty unprecedented. Why so many in some particular states?
Yeah, I think overall we're seeing an opioid epidemic across the United States, and the areas that seem more prone to that, it's largely around, like, what is coming into that area, what type of product, like the dosage level, the purity levels. Is it laced with something else like fentanyl, which is a stronger opiate and can be highly toxic? Or is there also, like, this element of, like, working with maybe prescription doctors who are overprescribing and might be prescribing a variety of things, like such as opiates and benzodiazepines, which can increase the likelihood of overdose?
Wow. Okay. Well, the good news, we've heard that Aetna is now the third insurance company to announce it's removing a barrier that had required a doctor's referral for people to get covered for addiction treatment. I would think that would be a pretty big deal.
Yeah, this is a great step. Hazelden has been advocating for the expansion of treatment through insurance companies for a long time, and, like, we think this is a wonderful next step in order to provide treatment for people who need it.
All right, Gloria Anderson, supervisor of the addiction program at the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation. Well, a new limited series, Big Little Lies, starring Oscar winners Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon, begins later this month on HBO. VOA's David Byrd has this look at the series, which is a dramedy, looking at the complex lives of three women.
Jane Chapman is a single mom whose son Ziggy is the result of a drunken one-night stand with a man named Saxon Banks. Jane, played by Shailene Woodley, is on her way to enroll her son in kindergarten in Monterey, California, when she meets two other women, Madeline McKenzie, played by Reese Witherspoon, and Celeste Wright, played by Nicole Kidman.
This is Jane Chapman. She's new here.
Hi.
Welcome, Renata Klein.
Thank you.
This is Emma Bella.
Hi.
Beautiful dress.
How was your summer?
It was wonderful. Very busy with the kids and camp. Just flew by.
Same.
How was yours, yeah?
Well, joined the board of PayPal. What was I thinking? Adding one more thing to my life. But, you know, oh, hold on. These are my Hamilton tickets.
Okay.
I've seen four times.
Yes. I'll see you in there.
Madeline is resentful that her daughter from a previous marriage is growing closer to her ex-husband's new wife, Bonnie. Celeste is routinely abused by her banker husband, Perry, played in the HBO series by Alexander Skarsgård. Their complex relationships make up the crux of the story. The movie is based on the book of the same name by author Leanne Moriarty. She said at the premiere at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood that executive producers Kidman and Witherspoon had kept the screenplay faithful to her work.
Yeah, well, they've definitely stuck fairly closely to the story, and I've enjoyed seeing, so I can see some sentences of dialogue that I actually recognize, and some parts where I think, I hope I wrote that and not David E. Kelly. I want to get the credit for it. And so some parts they've taken different little steps with the storyline, but no, mostly it's quite true to the book.
The series is directed by Canadian Jean-Marc Vallée, who directed Witherspoon in the Oscar-nominated Wild and helped Matthew McConaughey win the Oscar for Dallas Buyers Club. At the premiere, Nicole Kidman said that Vallée has brought a cinematic sense to the limited series.
It unravels, you know, the story unravels. But you go with it, hopefully. I hope that people watch all 7 hours because it's meant to be watched as 7 hours because it's the way Jean-Marc works. He obviously makes films first and foremost, so he's brought that cinematic sense to this piece. But you can't just watch 1 or 2 hours. You have to see it all because there's method to the madness, put it that way.
Reese Witherspoon said at the premiere that she hopes that women in the audience can see some of themselves in this series.
It's powerful, you know, when you actually connect with women and reflect back to them, their lives, and they see themselves on film. I think they have a bigger connection to the material. So I'm excited for women to see this and hopefully identify which character they're most like or see themselves in this show.
Big Little Lies also stars Laura Dern, who plays the overbearing mother Renata Klein. She says she sees the film as a reminder of women's power and influence.
Even more meaningful to be reminded that there are power in numbers and power in female numbers, and to celebrate each other and to use our voices to come together to tell stories, to get stories out there. This is a beautiful time to be doing that.
The 7-hour-long series starts on HBO February 19th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at the National Prayer Breakfast, President Donald Trump said, "Our republic was formed on the basis that freedom is not a gift from government, but that freedom is a gift from God. One fundamental freedom, freedom of religion, includes the freedom to worship according to one's own beliefs. Freedom of religion is a sacred right," said President Trump. "But it is also a right under threat all around us, and the world is under serious, serious threat in so many different ways. We have seen unimaginable violence carried out in the name of religion, acts of wanton slaughter against religious minorities, horrors on a scale that defy description. Terrorism is a fundamental threat to religious freedom. It must be stopped, and it will be stopped. We have seen peace-loving Muslims brutalized, victimized, murdered, and oppressed by Islamic State terrorists. We have seen threats of extermination against the Jewish people. We have seen a campaign of ISIS and genocide against Christians, where they cut off heads," said President Trump. "All nations have a moral obligation to speak out against such violence. All nations have a duty to work together to confront it and to confront it viciously if we have to," said President Trump. "The United States will do everything in its power to defend and protect religious liberty in our land. America must forever remain a tolerant society," said President Trump, "where all faiths are respected and where all our citizens can feel safe and secure. As long as our liberty, and in particular our religious liberty, is allowed to flourish," said President Trump, "America will flourish."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
is for, what's your